so welcome to Mindspace. I'm Dr. Joe Flanders. I'm the founder and managing director of Mindspace. I'm really pleased to have Christian Roy with me today for this, what should be a very interesting discussion of well-being and resilience at work. You can get more information about this conversation and everything that we're doing at Mindspace at on the internet, on the web at mindspacewellbeing.com, and at Mindspace Clinic on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. So I'm very pleased to introduce Christian. He is an executive vice president of the health division and a partner at Tank, which is a large advertising agency in Montreal. And he's got a really interesting story to tell about his experience in the last 6 months to a year. So really looking forward to getting into that. Christian, why don't you tell people how what you do and how people can find you online.
Good. So as you mentioned, I'm an executive vice president for the health division at Tank, which is a large agency in Montreal. And we have about 50% of our business is in consumer types of business, banking, insurance companies, retail industry. But the other 50% is health, mostly pharmaceutical. And because of my background, I spent over 20 years in the pharmaceutical industry. So I head up that division. And online, they can find me under my name, Christian Roy, on Facebook. And then we'll post my blog information on your site.
Yeah. So that's a key note here that Christian has written this really compelling sort of blog post or short story or something that kind of gets into the details of what we're going to talk about here. And we're really excited to see that online. And we'll definitely flag it for everybody so people can check it out on his blog. So if I understand correctly, you went through a pretty intense burnout.
Yeah.
Maybe you can just provide a little context around that. So what was going on at the time?
So basically, it's interesting. So in late April of 2017, we had just... So you said I was a partner at Tank. I used to be a partner at Tank, but we sold the business. So technically, I'm no longer a partner, but I'm part of a what you call an earn-out period. So so in December of 2016, we actually sold to a large network. We had been looking at attaching ourselves to a larger network to really help us fuel the growth and we really found the right partners. So we sold the business, but as part of the deal, we were going to stick around for 6 years, actually. And as part of the earnout, there was a payment upfront, and then there was a payment after a year and X years and another. So without giving too many details, there was a financial incentive not to just stay, but also to perform. So we started 2017 with really good momentum. And my division, the health division, had been running very smoothly and strongly, big growth over the previous 3-4 years, and we were doing really well. And we had really helped fuel Tank to a point where we were interesting to a larger network to be acquired. And we finished 2016 with good momentum, but like in any business, stuff happens. And, January came along, results were okay. February were not good, but hey, shit happens. So it's a bad month. March was really bad, made February look pretty good. And April was as bad. I actually went on a 1 week vacation with my wife. We attended a wedding in the Dominican Republic at the end of April. And frankly, if you had asked me coming out of the airplane after a week how I felt, I would have said, feel great, just spent a week in the Dominican. Weather was great, it was a wedding, lots of good friends, people I love, and we had a great time. So all in all, pretty good. But there was like almost that ticking time bomb. And I knew that at that point, February wasn't good. March hadn't been good. And here we are at the end of April. And in a few weeks after coming back, I was going to get the results for April, hoping that things turned around. But, you know, as you probably know, Joe, hope is not a great business strategy. So I knew inside myself that April was probably going to be pretty bad as well. And so I went from thinking I was feeling pretty good to dreading to see those April financial results. And then they came in and they were bad. And to a point where after 4 months, I knew that we weren't going to achieve our 2017 financial target. Now, you know, you could listen to this and say, okay, like what's a year in the business? The problem was that as part of the deal, that year one target was extremely important in terms of a payout. And we were five partners. So all of a sudden, it wasn't just about me. So the performance of my division was now impacting four other individuals who were working super hard, were getting good results. As time progressed, I realized that this was weighing very, very hard on myself. That started to create a huge amount of stress. I need to be clear. My partners never came to me at any point to say, hey, what's happening? You know, you're not performing. We're not going to hit our target. We're not going to hit our financial reward. They were all, from the very beginning, very supportive, saying things like, you know what? You know, you helped us get to where we were. If it hadn't been for your division, who knows if we would have gotten an offer. And you know what? We're a team. We win some, we lose some, but we do it as a team. So don't put pressure on yourself. And so much so that at one point, they stopped sending me the financial reports because they knew it was going to stress me and it wasn't a good thing. So from that point, things, I started to become really anxious, which then, you know, you don't sleep well, therefore you're not rested. I didn't want to eat. I kind of slowly stopped eating. I was still exercising, but I wasn't as diligent as I used to be. And then the little voice inside myself starting to take more and more space and becoming louder and louder.
It sounds like it was really not necessarily letting, you know, yourself down or not achieving your goals. It was really the impact on your partners that was really the trigger more than anything else. Is that fair?
Yeah, that was the weight, because I could handle, okay, I'm not performing, my division's not performing, therefore I'm not getting the reward. I mean, that's part of the game. But now it was having an impact on these four other people who were my partners and my people that I'm very, very close to, who brought me in as a partner, trusted me. And I gave back a lot. I mean, I was, when I got in and I invested, it was a good deal for both parties. But now at the most critical moment in our history, at least that's what I was saying to myself, now is the time that I'm letting them down. And I was just struggling. And at a time where I needed to be really focused and look for solutions, I started spinning down. Yeah. And I was losing control.
Right. So you mentioned that you felt really anxious.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that there was this very critical or negative self-talk or voice in your head or whatever. How did this anxiety manifest? So I want to hear more about the, you know, what this voice was saying, but also what are you experiencing day to day? Is it you're feeling on edge? Is it difficult to relax? Do you feel tense?
Like, yeah. So all of those, like on edge, difficult to relax, and to a point where, for example, I couldn't meditate. I thought, okay, I need to calm down, so I'll meditate. And I haven't been meditating as much as I used to in the last 2 or 3 months. You let go of all the good things that you do. All of a sudden, you stop doing them at a time where you need them most. So I couldn't meditate, but I just could not meditate. I would stop, you know, and try, but my head was spinning so fast that I just couldn't meditate. So I would stop. I didn't stick to it. And then, as a matter of fact, I came to understand at one point that in some cases, people can't meditate, or they will stop meditating when they go through this. And then the voice was just, you know, again, it wasn't psychosis, or I wasn't schizophrenic. And I knew that the voice is that it's the eye of the mind. You know, it's that little thing that is always with you that, you know, I say, if you're playing golf and you miss your drive, it'll say, oh shit, you know, you missed the drive, or, it's always that voice that we have that really talks to you and gives you feedback and tends to be negative. But in my case, I was a pretty positive person. So the voice was often very, very positive, prior to that period, and say, hey, you know, you're doing well. And, you know, when I transitioned from the corporate world to the, more entrepreneurial, you know, agency, it was like, hey, you know, not a lot of people are able to make that switch and be so successful in both. But now that voice really, it was negative. It's like, now, you know, you're letting them down. You're not, you've let things slip away. And why weren't you on top of things? And how could you let that happen? And now these individuals who trusted you, you know, how can they trust you? And, you know, frankly, if one of them had done that, you know, how would you have reacted? And it was louder and louder, more present and more negative. And it was just me beating myself down. And you know, the being on edge, anxiety. So I would fall asleep because I was tired. But then I would wake up at 3 or 3:30 or 4, and then the voice started. It's like the wheels are spinning, and it's, you know, thinking about, and not so much solutions oriented, but problem focused. And there was just no way. And that lasted probably a good 3 or 4 months. If I was awake, it didn't matter what time, there was just absolutely no way I was going to fall asleep again.
So how are you able to go to work in that period?
Well, you know, fortunately, my youngest kid is in high school, and he gets up early. And so my wife gets up and the house wakes up. So I would just go through the motions and just crawl out of bed, go into the shower and just get dressed and just put myself in the car and get to work. But very quickly, I became completely useless at work. I mean, I wasn't able to focus. So to the anxiety became all these other cognitive symptoms. So my ability to focus on a task, my ability to concentrate, my short-term memory, all of these things started not working the way they used to. So I just wasn't very useful at work.
At a time where you really needed to be at your best to try to right the ship on what was happening in your department there.
And what was even, you know, we were talking about the voice, is that when I was in the corporate world, often they would refer to me as the crisis management guy. In times of crisis, this is the guy you want to be with. This is the guy you want there because he's super calm when things get really messed up. And so I was thinking, I'd lost that all of a sudden. And now, and I started to think that that was a bit of a fraud. Like I was just at the right place at the right time and I had the right people around me. I wasn't really the guy. I just, so, because see, now it's happening. And when you need, it's now it's your crisis and you're not even showing up. To the contrary, now you're panicking. I mean, I used to be the guy who would see an accident on the highway. I would pull my car, get out of the car and just, you know, get involved, right? And my wife would say, or my kids would be afraid that I'd get in trouble one time because I just get right in there. If there's a crisis and there's a need for action, I'd be there. But when my crisis came, I wasn't there. So I started thinking that that whole thing was a bit of a fraud.
So you're slogging through the workday for 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
Presumably, you know, doing your best, but maybe not as productive as you'd want to be. What happened then?
Yeah. So what happened is, you know, end of April is when I come back from Dominican Republic, start, you know, kind of sliding down or spiraling down. And, you know, my partners would say something like, you know, you need to take care of yourself. You know, you're putting too much pressure. You know, we're going to get through this. You've only been with us for 4 years and, you know, we haven't had much of a down cycle, but that's par for what you've lived the last 4 years is amazing. But what we're now living is just part of a cycle. But it just didn't resonate with me. But showing up, not being able to do things, participating in executive meetings and not being able to contribute and just being sitting and silent. And that just wasn't the person that they were used to. So at one point, it was towards the middle of the month of June. And Mark, who was one of the partners and is now my boss, said to me, he said, listen, I think you need to take some time off. Why don't you take some time off and just find a way to get better, focus on yourself. Let us take care of the business. We can manage, you know, things are not going to stop. And so I agreed. I had a meeting in Vancouver coming up the following week. So I said, let me just continue. What I'll do is next week, I won't come in on Monday. I'll leave to go to Vancouver on Tuesday and do the meeting on Wednesday. And then I'll take, it was going to lead to Saint-Jean-Baptiste. So I'll take that and I'll add a few days and we'll see how it goes. So that was the plan. The following days, I just kept on getting worse. And now I was like, I didn't know how I was going to make it to Vancouver. Like, how can I get into a plane and fly for 5 hours and find the hotel, like things like that I had done. Like I traveled the world and been in meetings and, you know, in Seoul and in Tokyo and traveled on my own. Now I was afraid that I wasn't going to make it to Vancouver. So I did. I remember I took a red eye flight and I bought myself like a business class ticket so that I could sleep, you know, and go to the meeting the next day and just, so I did that. You know, thank God, the client was a good client and I managed, I went on autopilot as much as I could. I'd probably give myself like a 6 out of 10, on the way I managed that meeting and the way I moderated. Maybe I'm a little tough on myself. I think I have a lot of experience. So I managed. Came back home and then just, I was happy that now I was home. I'd made it through the trip to Vancouver and I took some time off. But as I thought, okay, now I can relax, but that didn't happen. As soon as I was off the Monday where I should have gone to work, I became obsessed with going back to work because now what the voice was saying, now you're really bailing. You let them down and now you're bailing. You're not even showing up at work, right? So I became obsessed, but I knew I'd spoken with Mark and we talked about like at least 2 weeks. You need to take a significant amount of time. So I don't even remember exactly what I did during those 2 weeks, but I remember being obsessed about going back. So I was going online, logging onto my email, you know, responding. And so I didn't really disconnect. And I came back and I said, okay, it's cool. I'm back. I took some rest and so I felt good for a short period of time about, okay, I managed to get back and I'll get through this. But took a couple of days of vacation. And by the way, anybody who knows you, I'm not a workaholic. Like I've always had a good life, a work-life balance. I would take 2 weeks in the summer. Sometimes I took 3 weeks. Like I take my breaks and I'm not one to stay in the office until 11 at night. And so I kept on showing up at the office, but within 48 hours, the pattern was back. And now I was just starting to continue to do a spiral down. Luckily for me, it was the July and August month, so less busy, a lot of people on vacation. But frankly, there were days I would come in, turn my computer on, and I'd look at my screen for hours and hours. Like I was past the going on La Presse website or CNN or... I couldn't even focus. And by that point, I liked watching series on Netflix, or I didn't watch anything, nothing. I didn't feel like watching anything, not even comedy, nothing. I'd stopped reading. I couldn't watch the news. There's nothing I liked to do anymore. There was really, I was just spiraling.
Sure. Yeah. So it sounds like you might have moved from a high level of anxiety, and either in combination or maybe the new trend was this sort of depressed mood with the lack of interest and fatigue and just sort of being a zombie.
Yeah. And that's kind of the conclusion, and we'll go into, you know, how I got help and all that. But I am convinced that the anxiety caused the depression rather than the other way around. So I went from being very anxious to now I was depressed and I was going through depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you listed some of the symptoms there. Maybe what else? Why do you call it a depression? What were the sort of the characteristics of that mood state?
Well, it's like the joy of life had been sucked out of my body. Yeah. There was just nothing that gave me pleasure anymore. And like I have four children, very close to them. And I would say that even I still enjoyed having them near me, but there was nothing that was giving me, like it's like life had been sucked out of myself. So add on top of that, you know, I didn't remember if I, like my wife had asked me to take the garbage, let's say, out. I had to check outside whether I'd taken the garbage out, like in the last 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. So like memory, concentration, ability to have, like I couldn't contribute in even social discussions. Mm-hmm. Like the guy who knows a lot about a lot of things and he's always talking to everyone, all of a sudden, like in with friends, I'd be on my chair and I would listen, not understanding half of what they were talking about.
I loved how you talk about this fantasy your negative thoughts conjured up about the end of this whole thing was you being in Carré Vigée,
okay,
or Vigée Square in Montreal. And maybe you could just tell us that, paint that picture for us.
Yeah. So... So I had started around the month of June or July. I started to see a psychologist. Actually, you were kind enough to refer me to somebody that you knew. So I started to see this psychologist. His name is Jean-Marc. He does cognitive behavior therapy, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. So during one of the sessions with Jean-Marc, I had some good conversations. So I had good moments with him. We were still able to, you know, you would start and say, how are things? And I'd say, they're awful. Like, I'm feeling like shit. Like, I'm feeling horrible. But we were still able to have with him some intellectual kind of conversations. And because he would tell me about, you know, if he gave me explained a tool, something that we could do, you know, he would explain that. And I'd say, yeah, that kind of makes sense, but not going to work with me. It's not kind of stuff that is going to bring me out of where that hole that I'm in. So a conversation we had, it was that how I told him I was going to wind up within 6 to 8 weeks. I was going to, or maybe a little bit more than that, in the next 6 months. But it was a short time frame. I was going to wind up in Karivigé as a homeless man. He said, oh, that's interesting. He said, why do you say that? I said, well, first of all, I'm off work. I'm never going back to work. And if I do, it'll be like in May. I'm going to be there. I'm going to fail. And they'll see that very quickly this time. And at one point, these guys are just going to say enough is enough. They're going to throw me out. So I'm going to wind up without a job. And I'm not going to be able to find it. How can I can't even keep the job that I know. How am I going to find another job? So nobody's going to hire me. And so that's going to create a financial issue for me. And my wife is there. She's supporting me. But at one point, she's going to get fed up. I mean, she's in her early 50s. She's beautiful. She's intelligent. She's going to say, okay, I need to survive this. Like, I'm drowning. She's not going to allow herself to drown. So at one point, she's going to call it quit. And my kids, they're like, you know, they're 13 or in their early 20s. They're like, at one point, they're going to move on with their life. The last thing they want is to spend time, any significant amount of time with their loser father, who's just like, and so financial difficulties, no job, no wife, no kids, no friends. Therefore, I mean, eventually I'm going to get kicked out of my house. And what am I going to do? I have no money, no jobs. So I'm going to wind up in Karivigé. Right? And I was like, if you had been sitting there, Joe, I would have told you the story. And I was convinced. And Jean-Marc was nice about it. You know, you can imagine he had a different perspective than me. And he said, interesting. He said, you know, if I could put all the money that I own, and if I could mortgage my house and take my kids' savings for education, and if I could bet on the fact that that's not going to happen to you, I would put every single dollar that I have, because I know it's not going to happen to you.
How did you respond to that when he...
Well, we laughed. It's funny enough, we I chuckled. I said, yeah, well, you're not me. You're not inside of me. You don't know. And I want to think like you think. He said, listen, first of all, the story you've just told probably happens, you know, once in a while in a very specific, but not in your condition. Not with the kind of support that you have from your partners, from your wife, from your children, the environment, the fact that you're sitting here with me and we're talking this through. He said, it's just not going to happen. But he said, I kind of get that, you know, that's what you think.
So he challenged the fantasy a little bit and did some reality testing with you, which obviously is part of that cognitive behavior therapy model. I'm guessing... that was part of your work with Jean-Marc. Anything else that sort of stuck out in terms of what was helpful about the therapy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's, and again, without going into too many details of the technicalities of CBT, but one is trying to retrain yourself to say, okay, if, you know, who's your best friend? Okay, my best friend is Johnny. So if Johnny came to see you and told you the situation and what his fears are, what would you tell him? You know, so for example, he'd say, about the work environment. You know, okay, so you weren't able to deliver on the revenues with this client because this happened, and you've got an explanation. If that happened to Johnny, would you say, Johnny, you're a loser? Like, I can't believe you. No, you'd say, hey, Johnny, this is business, par for the course. You win some, you lose some, stuff happens, that's out of your control. And so, funny enough, I was still able to say, yeah, that's what I would tell Johnny. But my little voice wasn't buying that.
Right.
My little voice was still telling me that I was a loser because I had let that happen. And
curious to hear what sort of snapped you out of this. And sounds like there's a really interesting and important story about your experience trying medication.
Yeah.
And then some of your own resources that kicked in at some point.
Yeah. And maybe before I go there, because I did go back off work. So I continued to go to the office and kind of look at my screen. Yeah. And at one point, actually, my wife, Wanda, God bless her soul, she was looking at all sorts of ways to get me out of this situation. And she said, why don't we go to New York? You know, we'll take Maxim, our youngest, and we'll go to New York for 3-4 days. And so she rented an apartment right on Times Square. And so to me, that was like if you'd stick a knife in an electrical outlet. I mean, my nerves were shattered. I couldn't hold myself. And I wind up on Times Square in a hotel, like even in our room in the middle of the night, even with the blinders down, I would still see lights flashing. I mean, you know, I think her intentions were really good, but we still laugh about it today, but probably not a good, we need to go back to New York now. But so I came back from those 4 days off, went back to the office for the week. It was the week following the Labor Day weekend. And on the Friday, we had an executives meeting. And at the end, Mark kept me and he said, okay, this is not working. And it's Mark, your friend of 25 years. Guy, what are we going to do? Are we going to wait until I need to go in the office and call 911 and put you in an ambulance? And like, this is not working. So I feel I absolutely need to tell you to pick up your stuff and go home. And you know what? Forget about the rest of 2017. Take 3 months. We're going to take care of business. You know, we were well covered with insurances and all that. It's not going to make a difference financially for you, but you need to take care of yourself. You need to get better because right now, you're not helping yourself. You're not helping us. You're not helping your wife. You're not helping your kids. And he said, I'm just afraid that there's going to be no end to this. So you just need to pack up. So, and I started crying and I said, I think, yeah, you're right. So the only thing though, in that meeting is I asked him, he said, we'll manage, we'll tell people. And I said, you know what? When you tell people, tell them that I had this urge, and I'm not sure why. And I guess it's because it's who I am, like fundamentally. But I said, tell them that I'm in a depression. Tell them it's a burnout. And we tried like a couple of weeks and, you know, I tried to come back, but it's not working. And I just don't want, whenever I come back, I don't want this to be tiptoeing around this or pretending that. That's the only thing I asked him to do. And he did that. So I went back home and I was off. That was early September. I went back in mid-November. Mm-hmm. So I was completely off. And they disconnected me. Like they blocked all my access to emails, anything on the server. I could not access any information, and they gave strict directions to people not to be in touch with me unless I did, from a social point of view, not to get in touch with me.
But it sounds like that speaks to the culture at Tank, that they handled it in this way, particularly your partners, but
yeah,
that's setting the tone for everybody and yeah, the transparency that you requested. What can you say about the culture at Tank that permitted all that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely in our DNA, the transparency, the collaboration. We're a big collaboration organization. And I know that I was extremely fortunate to be in that kind of environment that allowed these things to happen. And I think as an organization, we grew out of that. They you know, I was talking to the partners and they were all super supportive. I mean, little anecdotes of, I would, you know, when I was fed up of watching the screen for 2 hours, I'd leave and I'd go, we're in old Montreal, so I'd go for long walks. And, you know, one of them would find me or would call me. Where are you? Well, I'm on the corner of this street and this street. Okay, I'll be right there. And they'd walk with me, you know, and it was always about, you know, you need to find a way to get better, and maybe you shouldn't be here. And sometimes they would just say nothing and we would just walk. So, you know, Valia, Lynn, they would do that. And I remember Lynn, who's my one of my key people at work, would tell me, hey, Guy, you know, she'd call me Guy. I think you need to go home. And so, but that's the kind of culture that we have. You know, it's a lot of people say we're one big family, but we are. And so we grew through that experience, because here I was, one of the key, you know, executives at the company, one of the former partners, going through this. And, you know, I remember Max saying, it's a humbling experience for all of us. And the fact that you're going through that, it just tells us that we need to be careful. And so, you know, so we just have that kind of DNA that allowed me to go through this the way I did.
Okay. Well, so you finally sort of cut and run. You're home. You don't have any access to work. And now your only mandate is to get better.
Yeah. So, you know, you referred to medication. So back in 2000, I'd had, when I went through my divorce, I had a bit of an episode where I wasn't feeling great. And so my doctor at the time had put me on an antidepressant, and it worked really well, helped me get out of it rather quickly. So when around probably mid to late May, when I was starting to feel that anxiety, and so my doctor and I had a discussion, and throughout this episode, it's always a conversation with my GP, who's an amazing guy, and we'd talk about it. What do you feel? And so I had told him about what I had lived through in 2000, and he said, well, why don't we put you on the same medication? So it worked, but it worked for me at a high dose. So he said, but I can't start you at the high dose. Let's say the high dose is 40. So I'll start you at 10, and we'll wait, you know, 10 days, we'll bring you up to. So the whole thing about the medication, and it's so critical, is that first of all, medication helps. It's not a magic bullet, but it really helps. It can help you. And if your physician thinks that you can, then you should, but you have to stick with the process. I hear of many people who will try antidepressants for 5 days or a week and they get side effects and they stop. And it's almost a guarantee that if you go on antidepressants, you will have side effects. They're there for a transient period and then they subside by and large, they subside to a point where a lot of people have no side effects. But every time you up the dose or you change medication, you'll go through that. So 10 days at 10, no impact. Okay, let's go to 20, no impact. Wait another 10 days to two weeks. Go to 40, which was the dose that I'd been on. Then wait 1 week, no impact. 2 weeks, no impact. Okay, so guess what? It happens. It worked 17 years ago. It's not working anymore. So let's try to change to another medication, similar one, but that has... Because I also had difficulty getting out of bed. I had no energy in the morning. So we tried a different one, same pattern, first dose, second dose, third dose, no effect. So now it's like we're talking weeks and weeks and now months, and I'm not feeling, so where am I going to wind up being one of those people that doesn't respond to pharmacotherapy? And we decided on the third one to try a different class. First dosage didn't work, second dosage didn't work, third dosage, oh, I'm starting to now feel better. Now, by that time, there's the medication, I'm doing a CBT with my psychologist, and the one thing that I never gave up when I was at home is I would get out of bed, and when my son would leave to go to school, I'd find a way to get my body to the gym. My wife got me to join the gym in our area, and I would go to the gym. So I'd either do a spinning class, I'd go on the treadmill, I would do the stairs, the elliptics, whatever it is, but I would try to get at least an hour. And that gave me, you know, the endorphins would kick in, and it would make me feel better. When I was at the gym, and then for maybe a couple of hours after, I was getting a bit of a break. And getting a break becomes what you're looking for. So it's getting that pain of depression, because it's a real pain. It's like a pain in your soul where you wake up, and then there's 2 or 3 seconds before you start feeling the pain, and you're thinking, oh, maybe the pain's gone, and then it kicks in. And so you're looking for, how can I get that pain under control? So in my case, and I know it's the case for a lot of people, exercising would give me a bit of a break. It wouldn't completely go away, but I would get a bit of a break. And then the afternoon, I'd go on my bike, and I'd ride for an hour, 2 hours. You know, combine the not eating, because I wasn't hungry. I was nauseous. I didn't want to eat. So I was just getting shakes and then exercising like crazy. So when I landed from the Dominican back in April, I was 189, and now I was 159 pounds. So I'd lost 30 pounds. For a guy who could lose 10, if he wanted to get in his, you know, tip-top fighting shape, maybe 10, but not 30. So then at 159, my clothes don't fit, my pants don't fit, and don't talk to me about going shopping for clothes, because I can hardly get out of bed. Last thing I want to do is be in a shopping center. So I'm putting my baggy pants and my belt, and I have to put yet another hole, and my t-shirts are too big. And so every time I look in the mirror, I see this guy who's just, I can't recognize. So,
Yeah. You had another really interesting anecdote about, so you get the break from the exercise, but there's also this break that you get. Sometimes you took some medications to help you sleep, which is obviously super important. And there'd be a brief moment after you take the medications, before you fall asleep, where the pain is gone, or what was that moment like?
So I would take the medication called benzodiazepines. So in addition to the antidepressants, I'd take these sleeping pills, and what they do is they manage the anxiety. So now I would sometimes take some during the day, but it makes you a bit of a zombie. So so I would definitely take them to sleep. And so that was kind of the golden few minutes, maybe 15 minutes to 30 minutes when I'd go to bed. I'd take the medication, the anxiety would go away, and I was in my bed. I was either reading, if I was, or just trying to fall asleep or playing on my iPad. And then the anxiety would go away and I would feel good. And all of a sudden I'd start thinking, wow, now I'm okay. Like, that's it. The pain has gone away. And then I started thinking, okay, well, tomorrow what if I, because I have two kids who live in Quebec City who study there. And I thought, what if I just took my road bike and buy a couple of bags that I can put on it? And why don't I cycle to Quebec City? And then I get all revved up and thought, okay, I'll do that. That's a great plan. And then I'd fall asleep, and then I'd wake up the next morning and there was the pain again. And then so the voice would then say, like, you're freaking stupid. Remember last night? You're thinking you would cycle to Quebec City. So now I was back into, how do I get out of bed? Mm-hmm. And facing that, you thought you were going to cycle to Quebec City. Like, right? So that just brought me down even more. And I thought, when I thought I was feeling better, I was actually almost delusional. But when you think about it, I was in great shape. I did rides for hundreds of kilometers. So to think that I could go and do this while I have the time and I'm not working is actually not such a stupid idea. And I have two kids there. I could see them. So, but in the morning, I thought, wow, that was the craziest idea you had. So that kind of compounded the anxiety. So, yeah.
Yeah, so just it's incredible how that that emotional state will color your perception of reality and perception of yourself. And the medication can just move you so easily, effortlessly from one state to another.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's incredible. All right, so you've got this recipe, right? Exercise. And did you want to elaborate on that, or do you feel you sort of...
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, so all of a sudden I'm starting to feel better. The fog is lifting. The pain is lifting. So, and I'm exercising. Now all of a sudden I'm eating. I'm starting to feel better. I don't have the nausea. That's related to both the anxiety and perhaps the medication. So I came out of there with basically my recipe to be mentally healthy. And basically it's, I need to be compliant to my medication. I saw a couple of times a psychiatrist actually to help my GP and I on the, are we on the right path for pharmacology? Because I had these, failure, successes of failure. And he said, he said, my recipe from a pharmacological point of view is, first episode, you're on medication for a year, and then you start weaning off. Second episode, you're on medication for a year, and then you kind of go off slowly. Third time, it's medication for life. So that was his approach. So for the next year, I need to be compliant on my medication. Mindfulness. So my practice of mindfulness and meditating and doing all the exercises around mindfulness to focus on being in the present moment. I need to do that.
What does being in the present moment do for you?
Well, it makes me enjoy life because life is happening in the present tense. So not dwell on what happened or didn't happen in the past, and not care too much about what's going to happen tomorrow. But like right now, I'm with you. Like, you're the most important person in the world. because you're the, and you two guys are here. Like, so you are the most important people in my life because you're the only ones in my life right now. And so, so what it does is that it's really about enjoying what I'm doing right now, the moment, and the mindfulness practice, because it is a practice. I need to practice it every day, and I, there's tools and exercises that I can do, and meditation is one of them, where I focus on taking all my attention and focusing on the present moment. So by practicing this, I can be more in the now. Mm-hmm. So the second exercise is critical. I need to continue to do that. And so for me, the recipe is, you know, 5 to 6 days a week, find a way to do something. So I continue to do that. My support network, I need to continuously manage, nurture my, so my friends, obviously taking care of my family, making the occasions for, to go and have lunch with my buddies. And I, you know, when life got busy, you know, the great thing about your close friends is that you can not speak for 6 months and pick up right away. But you know what? You need to nurture that. So maybe the 6 months is there if something happens. But why not, like, just in a little email or a little phone call? And so so I nurture my, my support network. I make sure that my people are there. And I have a coach. His name is Mike Lipkin, and I've known him for 15 years. And Mike is one of those guys who actually went through severe depression himself. So he knew, and he's a motivational speaker. So in spite of what he does, the fact that he had gone through depression, I gotta say he pulled every freaking trick in his bag to try to keep me on the phone. He'd call me like every week. He'd call me for, you know, for 2 minutes or for 15 minutes. And whether he was in Istanbul or in Toronto or in Mexico, he'd pick up the phone and he'd call me. And just to, he was a bit of a lifeline, you know, kind of, but he'd say, you know, wow, you know, wow, that's, and we went from focusing on forget about work and how can you build yourself to, at one point, it was making it through the next 3 hours. That's what's important. Like, just make it to the next 3 hours. We're not, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. Just focus on between now and 12. And when it gets to 12, you'll worry about that when you get to 12. So it was just, so that's also a big part of my support network. And those are things that you need to nurture. And just having what he calls and what we call like powerful conversations. Mm. And that too is being in the moment. And I mean, I'll give you an example. I was coming back from New York on Wednesday. And I was sitting beside this woman, and I just had my headsets. I could have put them on and just relaxed, but I thought, I'll strike a conversation. So she happened to be somebody who was doing fundraising at McGill. And then the girl across the aisle was at Concordia doing, managing the buildings. And we just had this amazing conversation. So you can have powerful conversations all the time. And so I try to really, so that's my recipe. That's kind of works, what works for me. Mm-hmm. And not everybody has the same recipe, but some of the fundamental elements are, yeah, I think, common.
Okay, so you're starting to feel better. You gain some momentum with that. You do a progressive return back to work.
Yep.
I'd love to hear you tell us how you addressed your team when you went back to the office.
Yeah. So just to give you a little perspective there. So I started feeling good in late October, early November. And at one point, talking with my psychologist, my GP, I wanted to go back. And I wasn't obsessed about going back, but I thought it'd be cool if I could go back for a period of time before the Christmas break, do the go back, the kind of get reintroduced to the business, and then we'll have 2 weeks in at Christmas, and then I can start 2018 like everybody else. So if I can get that out of the way. So I didn't get any pushback. The timing seemed to be good. So we decided there was 6 weeks between mid-November and Christmas. And I would do 3 weeks at 3 days a week and 3 days at 4 days a week. That would bring us to Christmas. So again, you know, that was welcomed by my partners. Although Max said, why don't you wait? Why don't you just enjoy these last 6 weeks? I explained, I said, I would really like it to just get that part out so that I'm like everybody else in 2018 and I can start in January fresh. So that's what we decided to do. So the day before I came back, or it was a Monday, so let's say the Friday before, we had a conversation about what we were going to do. And I said, you know, authenticity and transparency worked and it's going to continue to work for us because that's how we roll at Tank. And I said, if you're okay with that, when I get back on Monday, I'm going to do... So one of the things that I do is every Friday at 11:30, I do a couch meeting. So in our agency, in front of the, near the door, there's a couch where people go and crash and have social or business conversations. So on Fridays, I do a little 10, 15 minute couch meeting. We do a retrospective of the week, what went well, what didn't go well, you know, who's new, anything, you know, just to ground people in what has happened in the last week before the weekend and wish everybody a good weekend. So we do that. So I said, I'm going to have a couch meeting on Monday morning when I get in. And I normally stand up behind the couch and people are in the couches and some are standing and... And so called the meeting and everybody came. I was sitting on the couch, you know, and I said to the people there, I said, hey, happy to be back. Could be here telling you that I just finished chemotherapy and I'm in, you know, I'm able to come back, or that I had knee surgery. I had a knee replacement. But that's not what happened, right? I think Mark and the rest of the team were clear. I went through a burnout. I had a depression. I had a mental breakdown. And I said, that's what happened to me. I said, I want to be... And I'm sharing this with you because we say we should talk more about mental health. And we're a communications agency and we're in healthcare. So if we don't do it, who's going to do it? So I said, and I don't want to be any malaise and people being uncomfortable. That's what happened to me. I could have had cancer. I could have needed knee surgery, but I had depression. I had a burnout. So it is what it is. I'm back now. I'm lucky. I got out of it. I said, I'm not going to go into details about the journey or what helped me, or just because I don't want to bore you with the details. But if any of you wants to talk to me, whether for personal reasons, family reasons, or just out of curiosity, just book some time with me. We'll go have lunch, we'll have a coffee, whatever, and I'll tell you everything and anything that you need to know. I have no problem discussing anything that happened to me. And I said, but that may not be for everyone. And I said, it happened to me. Doesn't mean it's going to happen to any of you. But it also means that it could happen to any of you. This is just, again, it's like cancer. It's like we don't get to choose these things. And it's probably some things in my genetic background. I know that I've had big stresses, possibly bigger stresses than what I went through. And I came out of it, you know, unscathed and no depression, no burnout. But this time, you know what? It hit me and I fell down and I'm back. I don't know if it's going to happen to me again. It might. I'm certainly playing the odds and I'm applying my recipe, and I'm disciplined. I'm extremely disciplined about it. And so that was it. That meeting lasted 10 minutes. People were, they just reacted the way they reacted. Some were just, okay, like business as usual. Some I could tell got teary-eyed, and you could tell that for some reason it hit home. But that's it. The awkwardness was gone. I tell you, by the end of the day, it's like if I hadn't left.
Mm-hmm. So as you know, this is, a very interesting approach. It's not very common. There's still huge stigma about mental health in the workplace. And, I sort of see that as sort of an act of courage to really put yourself out there and be vulnerable like that in front of your team who, you know, looks to you as a leader. I'm just curious about the rationale to approach it in that way and what that might say, or what you might say to any other leader in an organization for how they might approach talking about mental health.
Yeah. So I would say to you very truthfully, I think it's the way I did it is probably the most selfish way to do it. Because I didn't want to deal with the malaise. I didn't want to deal with having to pretend. And like, so by coming out and being authentic about what happened, and I didn't make it bigger or smaller than it was. It's just the way it was for me. Then by doing that, this whole thing went away. And it just, so it was easier for me. You know, I compare it to, I lived through a divorce with, I had three kids at the time. And I've always said, like, taking the decisions in the best interest of your kids is the most selfish thing you can do. Because if you do that, they're going to be happy. And as a parent, Joe, you know, if your kids are happy, you're happy. So it's very selfish to do that. And it's also the right thing to do. I believe it is the right thing to do to be transparent about these things, because I don't see myself as a weak person. I think I'm a very strong person. But you know what? I got into depression. I burned out. And so the same way, I couldn't tell somebody who has lung cancer that they're weak, right? I mean, it's so, we can't. I mean, if you need to get your knee operated, am I going to say, oh, you're not an athlete, you're weak, right? So that's why I fundamentally believe, and I think it was given to me as a gift in many ways, and I'm going to use it. And like I said, healthcare, communication. If a guy like me doesn't do it, who's going to do it?
That's really interesting. Maybe one last question before we wrap up here. You mentioned someone in your entourage during this period said you might see this burnout as the best thing that ever happened to you. Yeah. I think you just mentioned that it was a gift.
Yeah.
And it took you a while to sort of reach that conclusion yourself, but I sort of got the impression that at this point you're almost grateful that this happened to you, that it is a gift. So how does that work?
Yeah. So first of all, it was the psychiatrist who was a very kind, gentle man, and had a lot of empathy. And the first time I went to see him, and I told him a little bit of where I was at the time and my story, and he said, you know, sir, I have to tell you something. You're very lucky to go through a burnout at your age. I was 53. And he said, I looked at him and I thought, what is it like? And he said, yeah. He said, you know, not a lot of people have the opportunity to take a break in their early 50s and just take an inventory of where they are in their life. And so I got the concept. I thought, okay, interesting. It did not resonate with me emotionally. I could not see this as being lucky. Who wants to feel like I feel? But with time, and it didn't take me a lot of time, because we're 2 months post my return from work, or almost 3 months. This analogy came to mind of a boot camp. So let's say, Joe, that you had let yourself go for the last 5 years. You stopped exercising, you're eating junk, and you're piling up the pounds. And you're now 100 pounds over your weight. And you decide, I need to do something. And you sign up for a 2-month boot camp. If I went to see you on day 30, and you had done a randonnée climbing up a mountain, it took you 2 hours with a backpack full of rocks, and then they came back, they threw you in a pool with weights on your legs to do laps for 2 hours, and now you were in the middle of doing 100 push-ups. And I went to see you and I say, "Hey, Joe, how are things?" You'd say, "I want to puke. Like, I want to die. And you know what? Get me out of here. I want enough, out, time out. I'm done. Okay? I just want out." But I'm a good friend, so I don't take you out. I leave you there. And then a month later, you finished, you've lost 105 pounds. You're in the best shape of your life. You now are back into healthy eating habits. You exercise. You're just on top of the world. If you look back at that boot camp, I bet you that you would not see that as a negative experience, right? You would see that as, you could still remember the day I went to see you and you wanted to puke and you were miserable. But even that day wouldn't be a negative thing. It's just what you had to go through in order to get to lose 105 pounds and have this new body and this new lease on life. So to me, it's a mental boot camp. I got to go through a mental boot camp. I had the opportunity and I was well surrounded. I had a great psychologist. I had an amazing GP. I have an amazing wife and children and friends and support and people like you who referred me. So it's like the ultimate Biggest Loser boot camp, but it was mental. And so I look at it and I see that as a positive experience, because I'm a different person. I've not changed completely, but I'm a better person than I was prior to my burnout.
That's a really inspiring story. Really appreciate you sharing with us. And I wish you continued fitness and and well-being.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you, Christian. Yeah.